I just arranged to talk with George Hart, who's now the librarian at UMass Lowell, but he used to be a reference librarian and other things at UMass Boston. And so when George first gave a presentation to my CCT 692 students, he spent a lot of time systematically, didactically, laying out the different kinds of online resources and the ways to construct searches. That was maybe 10 years ago. And there wasn't too much time left for students to get practice using those resources. But when he came back the next year, and within a few years, his presentation loosened up, and he spent most of his time just showing us, with his characteristic enthusiasm, how much you're able to find on a few topics that it interested you, that it interested him. So he then circulated around the lab, helping each student define and pursue their various searches. So I thought we could start today's conversation by seeing whether he could reflect on that shift and any shifts he's made since then.
Okay. Well, that was an enormously important learning experience for me. And it has completely changed everything that I do as a librarian, and that now that I'm trying to institutionalize here at this library. The thing that really hit home, Peter, working with your class, as you say, is the lecturing at people, just the sheer weakness of that as a method, and trying to just, entertain and list all kinds of things and go through scenarios, as opposed to having people engaging in their own personal search and providing support. So, I'll give you one concrete example. We're developing hundreds of class-specific and assignment-specific web pages. And the first generation of them, we thought we should present all kinds of links. So, someone writing a paper, in sociology or psychology, the guide might have 50 links without a lot of context, just saying, you can get all the books in the world here, or you can have the whole American Psychological Association data here. This tremendous cornucopia on the page. And we did that for a few years, and I started looking at the use, and it was like minimal, like people weren't clicking through. So for a pilot, we did some new pages. We said, hey, you have to write a 6-page paper. You have to use, empirical work in psychology where you have a sample size and a statistical methodology applied. Here's how to do that. So we would pick. We said PsychInfo from the American Psychological Association presents and indexes this information so you can work right here. And then we would put instructions, video instructions there. And then we would go to three levels. We'd have, and now in addition, there's this and there's this. And then we'd stop. And then we would have an example from a previous year. So look, the professor says this was a good way to approach it. We'd have that. And then we'd have a feedback loop. So, if you want some help, here's how you can do it, either chat or email. And then we would have a link at the bottom that would go back to what used to be the starting point. It would be the big page. They say, if you really love this stuff and you really want to explore, the sky's the limit. There's where you would go. And a class of 30, where you show them everything out of context, might have 15 hits on it. The same class of 30, when you focus and you bring them right in context, might have 1,500 hits. That was common. So now, we don't, the rule of thumb now is to keep everything focused and directly engaged, and also to send it, to flip the class session, to send the focused page to the class a week or two before they talk to you. And so let them work with that, let them try, explore on their own and ask questions individually, and then have a kind of a studio session where you log in or you show up in the room and you say, all right, how's it going? Let's everyone try what you're doing and let's talk about it.
So
that works.
So that sounds like a good shift for a focus class, like, you know, psychology 362 or something. But with my CCT students, they're doing all sorts of projects, and they may have, they may or may not have done a focused class and been introduced to the library beforehand. So one of my concerns is that they just reduce to a lowest common denominator of Googling something, and maybe that's not so bad, but I'm wondering how you would suggest approaching that kind of group. Yeah,
you know, it's perfectly consistent to say the type of assignment initially involves a very broad, not a scan, but an investigation. You really want some breadth. And then you make choices as you go forward and you pursue things in depth. And again, there is probably, you know, you would want to look at maybe three areas to do the broad scan. It works beautifully. For UMass Boston students, if they go to the on the database and indexes list, there's a under E, there's a thing called EBSCOhost. It has to be EBSCOhost, because that's the federated, you know, that is all of the EBSCO databases. And then when the window opens up, just click all, and then you run a search on that, and it's you know, it's extremely effective. It's probably the single most useful, you know, one starting point kind of, where you want to investigate across a range, a transdisciplinary basically investigation, and see what shows up. And that takes you, so, you know, it's limited to mostly to peer-reviewed articles, that's a really good starting point. And then in some ways there's the link now between what Google does and what UMass Boston Library does. And Google provides, in the right context, excellent discovery. So you might say, all right, I wonder what books, what monographs, across all disciplines, again, just really searching the literature of humankind, you know. So it turns out that Google has scanned 20 million books in books.google.com, word for word. But it also turns out that the UMass Boston is part of the Boston Library Consortium that has those 20 million books in print and will ship them to the library for your students to pick up in 3 days. So, I mean, this is like the best of, in some ways, it's astonishing. So they could go into Google Books and search whatever quirky or general or interesting, whatever they wanted to dig, and they're looking at billions of words. You know, in the past, the library catalog, you know, you may have heard this, Peter, you know, you write a book and it's, you know, 120,000 word book. A library catalog record would have 30 words. Peter, you know, your Taylor, and then the title, a few subject terms. Whereas in Google Books, it has every word that you wrote. So the discovery is phenomenal across just a whole range of literatures. I mean, just an example, there was a professor at UMass Boston going up for promotion who does a lot of research in the working poor. And it turns out that the mainstream economic journals really weren't that interested in the working poor, you know, surprise, surprise. But when she did a Google book search, she found hundreds of authors in the developing world, all over the, or also in maybe the more socially conscious economists in North. She found a lot in Scandinavia, but she found all of these people using her work because of the depth of indexing that Google Books offered, that she was completely unaware of, that, you know, how many people were picking up on her stuff that were interested in it. So, you know, right there, if you think of it as an ocean that the students can fish in, and then the library will get any book, any of those 20 million books for them in about 3 to 4 days.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So that's very powerful.
So let me try to imagine a situation where the group of students come to a class and we don't have a librarian, but I'm trying to coach them into doing, you know, finding out what other people are doing and what they've done, but also allowing for the fact that some people are more experienced than others, but also allowing for the fact that even the people who think they're experienced, like myself, there are always new things that new tools that are available. So how would we best sort of link with that heterogeneous class and get them enthused and excited, but also not just complacent, like I know how to do it, I've done it before, and so on.
It's a self-conscious or awareness of the kind of the scope and of the world that you're looking at, the kind of the epistemology or the sociology of knowledge. So, you know, if you have grad students,
they should
stop for a moment and they should check the database of theses and dissertations under D on the list. And, you know, it's 100 years or 100 and some odd years of graduate student work that they can get full text right there. So that's like a category. If they want to think, this is there, you know, Peter, a lot of the, I think in your department, there's a lot of leaps, creative leaps required, more than in some other areas. So, you know, one would be if you were looking at an environmental topic, you could step back and you say, well, you know, who might care about this, and how might I expand or refine what I'm doing? So, I mean, the example that I've used a lot at U.S. Boston, because I'm always looking out at the harbor, is the migrating whales, you know, the right, I think they're called the right whales. But it turns out that, believe it or not, they are susceptible to chromium. Oh, it's a compound, it's chromium something. Hexavalent.
That's,
I guess
it.
It's a form, hexavalent chromium. That comes from the smokestacks in Ohio and Indiana. And it affects humans, but for some reason, it in the atmosphere over the East Coast oceans, it affects the tissue, the lung tissue. But it's also a huge thing. Here at Lowell, they research because it's used in auto parts manufacture, and it's dreadfully harmful to workers. So we have people here who specialize in it. So it's basically one of these environmental contaminants. Just suppose you were curious about the story behind this environmental contaminant. And so,
in the next few minutes, George talks about not so obvious places to find research relevant to chemicals in the environment. But for interest of time, we'll fast forward for a few minutes.
You know, so if you were working on this, you then might ask yourself, you know, where else would I want to look? Would I look at dissertations people have written? Would I look at the book literature in Google Books? Am I interested in sociological? I would try the EBSCOhost, which picks up a very strong menu of liberal arts databases. It gives you history, sociology, psychology. It kind of takes you through the roster. So it would give you some clues to where the literature was clustering.
Then the
other one, the 33% of the world's scientific literature is published by one monopoly publisher called Elsevier. It costs Lowell, believe it or not, $560,000. Boston gets a deal. It's under $300,000. But it's called, again, it's under S, it's called Science Direct, one word. And so it's a third of the scientific literature in the world. That includes a lot of social science. So again, that would be a place to do a really, and it's all full text. Would be just a fabulous scanning site for various and sundry. And so after you caught your breath, if you just did these things that I mentioned on the topic, and then sort of took a deep breath, it would be saying things to you, what you started to see. You'd start seeing your own patterns. You would start the things you wanted to recognize. I did some. The other day, I took that old T.S. Eliot poem, where he talks about, what does he go? He goes from, you know, data
information,
to information, to knowledge, to wisdom, wisdom, right?
Yep, yep.
Well, I did some I went to the OED, which, by the way, we have online, the world's greatest history of the English language. And I looked at the history of the words, and it was kind of interesting. Data, which is linked to like a Sanskrit word, dutta, you know, which is, it's the idea of observe things which are, that would be observed, that which is.
Uh-huh.
And then information is pattern. Uh-huh. And knowledge, believe it or not, there's an older meaning of knowledge that I think may fit better, called recognition. Knowledge of something was the recognition of something. And then, of course, you know, wisdom was judgment. So the idea of looking at this literature search and then asking, you know, what kind of data is being reported here, and then what kind of patterns am I seeing, or am I recognizing? So seeing the recognition of the information into patterns, and then the judgment, and then you flip it around. You just draw an arrow from judgment back to data, because the judgments that people are making are shaping the kind of data they're collecting or what they're seeing in the world. And it's a nice pattern.
Great. So, I just presented an expanded version of that sequence to my epidemiology class. But let me just try to summarize and then let you off the hook what I would think that I should do next time that I'm trying to get students to do the very first session on finding out what's out there in the world, and you know, to how to do it in a way that allows for different people's experience. And I think that given that we're not having library sessions that present didactically all this information now, the focus is on getting you in and experiencing it, I would try to find a video of a specific case, I would give them an assignment that says, look, define the title of your project, and then go to Google, Google Scholar, and Google Book, and find one article and one book, and ask to borrow it by interlibrary loan, and ask to get a copy of the article by interlibrary loan, if it's not available on the system in full text.
Yeah, and they want to set Google Scholar in the settings. You go to preferences and you search on University of Massachusetts Boston, and you check it off. There's a couple of boxes you check, and then Google Scholar connects with the library holdings.
Great.
Just a side note.
No, that's good. Good to be reminded. And then I would ask them to find an article through EBSCO.
ESCO host, yeah.
Right? And a dissertation, and then use ScienceDirect to find an article. And you know, and they may come up empty on one of those, but at least my biggest worry was that by loosening up the presentations, we also didn't socialize them enough to the resources that are available to them as graduate students. You know, at a commuting university, sometimes they just don't recognize what incredible resources that are there.
Yeah, it really is special.
And so your contribution was great to get them enthusiastic about it, but I was realizing that as I watched them try to self-pace them through the online handouts, I realized there wasn't any grab to it. So this conversation, if they listen to this, or a video that shows them someone really getting in on a particular topic, plus some specific assignments, I think will get them into the system and also get them saying, hold on, I need some help here. And then, so rather than trying to work out in advance who needs help, I would just be circulating around. Any thoughts about that strategy?
No, it's excellent. It's really excellent.
Okay.
And examples are great. And it's kind of the holy grail, what you're working on, you're seeking. And I'm sort of halfway across on the journey, to be honest with you, Peter. There's just a lot of work to do to understand, you know, how to share the way our knowledge is organized and accessed, and what it all means, you know. It's It's the potential is so striking, but the challenges are just daunting to share it effectively.
Well, you mentioned the T.S. Eliot and added the data to it, but in my scheme, when I'm trying to get people to think about phenomena and categories and observations and data and analysis and so on, at the bottom of this sequence, I have actions that they favor. And I think that shapes the categories that people look at. But the flip side of that is when a student doesn't have a strong sense that they can influence the world, you know, what actions that would follow from the knowledge they're trying to put together.
That's
then
right.
Then it weakens the other steps too. So there's a chicken and egg thing in there. I have to, you know, my courses are research and engagement or action research, but I have to get them to believe that there's someone that they can influence. And once they do that, their searches can be more active, more pointed, more sometimes more personal. They're prepared to email or call a person who's done major work. When in the earlier stages, they just think, oh, look, I'm just a lowly student or I'm a busy worker who just has a couple of hours to come into class. So when you say it's a holy grail, I don't think it's a holy grail that can be reach just by the interactions around what the library's resources are. It has to be
extended
out into a classroom with teachers or coaches.
Yeah, and into your life.
And at certain points of the life, people don't want to believe that that they can do anything significant. So sometimes you just have to be patient until they take that turn. Anyway, look.
Can I just add one thing?
Please, go ahead.
I've been working with the idea of stories and coherence.
I saw that. Yep.
And just as all, which ties in with the idea of acting. I've been working with an approach where you would use all this knowledge and information and these resources to basically construct a story, a meaningful story about something. And then ask what's your role in the story, you know, because it's alive, it's still here. It probably has some, you know, there's some relevance and meaning and then if you put, so you basically you put yourself in the story. What would I do based on what I've learned? You know, what kind of life can I lead? And I was playing a little bit with coherence. I take that when I get a little further, I'll share it. But I got stuck in the Bertrand Russell's. There was a theory of truth value, of coherence as a truth test.
Mm-hmm.
That Bertrand Russell took it apart mathematically, and I'm wondering if there's sort of a non-mathematical value still in that the stories would have some kind of coherence in terms of your understanding and your ability to act on it too. So I'm playing with that. I'll see where that goes. I'll send it over to you.
Well, we have, when our book came out, The Taking Yourself Seriously, one of our students who graduated maybe 8 or so years ago, Jane LaChance, came and did a commentary. Well, a few other students did commentaries too, but hers, she's become a storyteller. You know, she works in healthcare.
Okay.
And she did a storytelling, and the coherence was, she's a very good storyteller now, so you saw, you know, little pieces got put into play, and then at the end you saw it come together. And it's not necessarily about using the library's resources, but it's about storytelling and coherence. And so this should be made more widely available. It should be viral on YouTube, I think. So I'll find you the link.
Okay,
and,
great.
And also I'm thinking that my way of moving people towards coherence is to make sure that we take stock at the end of any session, and in particular take stock with each person writing down a couple of questions or statements that have become clear for them during that session. So then they gradually, maybe incrementally, start to form the themes that are important to them. And maybe it's an ongoing process, a rolling coherence. Some things get worked out, but you always raise new questions. So I think that's not exactly what people do in stories, because stories are supposed to have an end point, but sometimes the best stories leave big questions open at the end, I suppose.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's wonderful.
And maybe what we've just done is also, we haven't structured as a story, but it is it could be a contribution to this process of trying to make sense of where you've come and where you're going.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Peter, this is the first non-administrative thing I have done in 8 months. It's a huge pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much.